We're going to finish today a series on love by talking about chesed, which I believe is finally the ultimate love that the biblical tradition shares with us, or shares wisdom and information and stories about. I'm going to finish with three texts that don't mention the word, but which to me exemplify what chesed is. It's the love of faithfulness, the love that comes after the love of heat. And the love of sheer passion. Not that it has no passion, it requires passion and it requires heat, but it is the long-term love of faithfulness that is exemplified throughout the scriptures in the lives of certain people, and particularly it's the way God's faithfulness and love toward us is described. It has some elements of passion. In Jeremiah 2, there is this text in which God laments the unfaithfulness of God's bride, Israel, and the lament starts, "I remember your devotion as a bride when we were out in the wilderness and in a land not inhabited, and you would follow me anywhere." That's love, right? That's the love of heat. We get that way. We get a whiff of a certain kind of love, and we'll follow that scent anywhere. But chesed ultimately will behave the same way, the love of faithfulness. Where you go, I will go. And our lives are linked forever. There's another text in Jeremiah that I wrote down the wrong reference for, so I can't read it to you because I can't go back and figure out exactly where it was. It's somewhere in the Book of Hope in the early 30s chapters of Jeremiah, in which Jeremiah describes chesed as eternal ahav, love. There's Hosea 6, in which God says, "I desire chesed, not sacrifice," which is then picked up by the New Testament, that same text. And the word in Greek is eleos, the word which we're familiar with when we sing the Kyrie, Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy. But it's more than just like pitying some poor, broken creature that's crumpled on the side of the road. It's the long-term love that will not give up. Micah 6. Mm-hmm. What does God want of you? Not rivers of blood and oil and sacrifice the fruit of your body for the sins of your soul, but that you do mishpat, justice, and that you love ahav chesed. To love chesed, to love this faithfulness, to cultivate it, to practice it, and to walk humbly with God. And Micah also even characterizes God this way in chapter 7. That among all the other things God does is God forgives, God shows compassion, God does all these things because God's delight, God's favorite thing is chesed. Oddly enough, The NRSV translates, because he delights in showing clemency. Is that lame or what? God's passion is risen. That's what Micah 7:18 says. Paul picks up on the desiring mercy, not sacrifice, in that famous section of the letter to the Romans, chapters 9 to 11, in which Paul tries to untangle the mystery of the Gentiles latching on to the promise of the Messiah, and Paul's own people, at the moment anyway, not. And Paul is agonized over this, and Paul offers the opinion that if this split had not happened between Christianity and Judaism, he would be willing to trade that for his own eternal salvation. One of those things that maybe somebody shouldn't have said. But he says at the end of that section, I don't know how this will turn out. I trust one thing, that God's last word is eleos. And even if God casts some people or allows some people to live apart from God, God does even that in order that somehow or another God can finally have chesed on everybody. So I've chosen three texts to look at today that I think are exemplary of chesed. Two different kinds of human relationships, and then a piece of the New Testament that talks about practicing as a way of life. So we're going to start with Hosea, chapters 1 to 3, the story of Hosea's marriage. And I want to show you some subtleties of this. I'm sure this is not new material to hardly anybody in the room. Hosea starts out by saying that when the Lord first spoke to him, Hosea is an 8th century BCE prophet. He prophesies along with Amos, Micah, and Isaiah, the first Isaiah. This is the time when there is the divided monarchy. The northern kingdom Israel is the larger and more prosperous, and in the 8th century they are at the height of their power and wealth. The smaller southern kingdom is stable and secure, and they too don't like each other a whole lot, but they're coexisting, and the prophets Micah and Isaiah in the south and Amos and Hosea in the north, all four of them at this point in history said, something's rotten in Denmark and we're going down the tubes if we keep acting like this. All four of them. But Hosea is the prophet that most determinedly clings to God's chesed. So when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take for yourself a wife. NRSV says whoredom. Older translation said harlotry. And have children of harlotry, for the land commits great harlotry by forsaking the Lord. So Hosea went and took Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Some people have said this must be some sort of story or allegory. This could not ever be anything that God would have told somebody to do, to go marry a prostitute. The way I understand how this kind of stuff works, Hosea was a guy who somehow or another got involved with this woman, and she was, or he later learned she was, a prostitute. And then he discovers through his relationship to her that, I believe I'm having something like a revelation here. I'm wondering if maybe God doesn't experience the relationship with our people the way I'm experiencing life with Gomer. And so he tells the story of the people out of his own experience. So Gomer conceived and bore him a son, and the Lord said, name him Jezreel. For in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And Jezreel was the site of a famous battle in which there had been an absolutely horrendous slaughter. A memorable kind of, like Gettysburg, or Belleau Woods, or someplace like that. So name this child Jezreel, field of slaughter. She conceived again and bore a daughter. And the Lord said to him, name her, and this sounds so pretty, just in transliteration, name her Loruhamah. Loruhamah. Sounds kind of pretty, right? Except what it means is nobody cares. Actually, we have here the word for compassion. And I went through this at great length last week. In case you've never heard this, the word for compassion is Hebrew. Is in Hebrew, or the idiom for compassion, having compassion in Hebrew, is to have a womb for someone, or to treat someone as though they have once been in your womb, like you are their mother and they are your flesh and blood. And the word for womb in Hebrew is rechem. And to have compassion is to have rechem, or in the plural, rechamim. Ruhamah is a word that means wound. So name this child not wound, never wound, a child that came from nowhere, a child that was never anybody's flesh and blood. The best way I can say how it would have functioned would be to say, this is, nobody cares. Like, who cares about this kid? This kid belongs to no one. So that when this child plays on the playground and someone says, who is that child? Nobody cares. And at school, what's your name, little girl? Nobody cares. And when she's buried, it will say, nobody cares who's buried here. To live without identity. Name the child Loruhamah, for I will no longer have Ruhamah on the house of Israel, or forgive them, but I will have pity on the house of Judah and save them. I believe there was a little bit of editing going on after this book got saved. This book was from the northern kingdom, which of course was destroyed soon after Hosea's time. We'll talk about the meaning of that later, given some of the things we're going to see. But then this book got saved in the south, and there's all sorts of additions, editing that went on in this book, especially at the very end, in which, yes, the northerners got what they deserved, but down in the south we got saved.
Yeah.
For a while they did anyway, and then they got it even worse than the north. When she had weaned Loruhamah, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, name him Loami. For you are not my people, and I am not your God. In many languages, including Hebrew, there is a separate word for us as human beings and everybody else. Some of you may know that the word Cheyenne means human being. So there's us, the Cheyenne. And then there's all those other, whatever they are. Am means people. Goy, Goyim, means all the rest. So Am is the word of being the genuine article. The people, God's people. And lo means not. So this child's name is really nobody. Who are you, little boy? Nobody. And at his grave it will say nobody is buried here. So the loss of identity. That's what you get for just connecting yourself by unfaithfulness and playing the harlot with the gods of the peoples round about. Your children end up no one, cursed. Chapter 2. There's some more editing going on, but we're not going to pay attention to because we're in the north, not the south this week. Another oracle. In that ancient time, if a man wanted to divorce his wife, all he had to do was to write a bill of divorce and give at least one reason why he was divorcing this woman. And all it meant was, this woman is no longer my property. I'm cutting loose any connection to her and any responsibility for her. And for much of the history of the people, that was simply the prerogative of a man, and he could divorce a woman because he didn't like her cooking, because he found somebody else who he liked better. Whatever, it didn't matter. Eventually there were strictures put on this and things you would owe a divorced woman if you got rid of her. Some rights were given to women to demand a divorce under certain kinds of circumstances. We went through some of this last week if some of you were here. If, for example, a Mishnah allows that if a woman marries a tanner who works with those terrible chemicals that up until fairly recently were the necessary part of creating leather from animal skins. And when you got that on you, you could not get that off and the smell would not leave you or the place where you worked and lived. And if a woman married a tanner and she thought she could put up with it, and then discovered after a year she could not abide that, it just wrecked her life. She had the right to ask for a divorce, or actually to demand a divorce. So there were a few things that women could allow, but men could basically just say, we have here in Hosea chapter 2 an example of a very long bill of divorce. It's a legal document. It's a lawsuit filed against the offending party, who is the wife here, who is being divorced. And the children are called forth to be the witnesses to this divorce. Plead with your mother. That's the verb for filing a lawsuit. It's the same verb you have here when in the wilderness stories, when the people discover that Moses has not thought of all the problems that need to be solved, like food and water and everything, and 3 days out into the wilderness, they file a lawsuit against Moses. Well, this is that same legalese. Plead with your mother. File this complaint. She is not my wife, and I am not her husband. That's all you had to write, plus then one reason. But this is an elaborate one. That she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, or I will strip her naked and expose her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness and turn her into a parched land and kill her with thirst. If you caught a wife in adultery, Torah says the penalty is that she be stripped naked outside the city gates and stoned to death. And the whole village participates. So this is the threat to bride Israel, wife Israel. Because of what you did with the Baals and the others, I'm gonna stone you to death outside the city gates. Upon her children, I will also have no pity, no compassion, because they are children of harlotry, and their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers. They gave me bread and water and wool and flax and oil and drink. And then this legal document has clauses that says what the consequences of the crimes are. And in English, this starts with the word therefore. Therefore, because of all this, I will hedge up her way with thorns, build a wall against her so that she can't find her paths. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but not find them. And then she will say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better with me then than now. So maybe I'll try confining her. I'll lock her up so she can't get to Baal. She didn't know that it was I that gave her grain and wine and oil and lavished silver and gold that they gave to Baal. Therefore, I will take back my grain in its time and my wine in its season. I will take away my wool and my flax, which were to cover her nakedness. Now I will uncover her shame in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand. I will put an end to all her mirth, her festivals, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her appointed festivals. Oh, how she loved to party. Put an end to it. I will lay waste her vines and fig trees, of which she said, these are my reward, which my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest, and wild animals shall devour them. I will punish her for the festival days of the Baals, when she offered incense with them and wrapped herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, says the Lord. One more therefore. Therefore, because of all that, I will now allure her. The word for wooing in Hebrew. I will bring her into the wilderness where we started all this and speak tenderly to her. In Hebrew, that means I will whisper to her heart. And from there I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor, a symbol of horror, a door of hope. And there she shall respond as in the days of her youth and at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. So all of a sudden, at the end of the bill of divorce, when the last therefore should say, and thus I am done with this woman forever, she is gone and of no concern to me, Hosea's oracle is that God says, you know, actually, what I think I'm going to do is have a second honeymoon. We're going to go away, just the two of us. And I will whisper to her again. And we will be together like we once were. And on that day, says the Lord, you will call me my husband. No longer will you roll over in your sleep at night and say, my Baal. God, I used to hate that. I'll remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall not be mentioned anymore. I will make for you a covenant in that day with all the animals and the birds of the air and the creeping things. I will abolish all the weapons and make you lie down in safety, and I will take you for my wife forever. I will take you for my wife in righteousness and justice, in steadfast love, and in chesed. And you shall know the Lord. And we're going to rename the children. So little Lo Ruhama and little Lo Ami, we're going to rename them Ruhama and Ami, beloved, my people. And they will say, you are my God. So, there is chesed in action, I think. When mercy and justice finally clash and come to a complete head, chesed is that mercy wins. It wouldn't have to, but in God's faithfulness, mercy trumps justice. To keep the relationship going, because God simply won't, perhaps even can't, let go of it. In some ways, this is just described as God's character, but it is also a consequence of the entire theology that grows out of Israel being God's chosen people. When you have chosen a people to be your last hope for the world, you are kind of stuck with them, right? Like that old joke about the married couple on their 50th or 60th wedding anniversary, asked by friends or the small town newspaper reporter or whatever, how did you do this? How did you get along for all these years? Did you ever think of divorce? And as you know the joke, one of them says, divorce? No. Murder? Yes. We're God and Israel, neither one of them has what they really want and need from the cosmos without the other. Because God has promised this is the last hope, blessing instead of curse. And Israel is nobody without the Lord. So these people, this couple is bound together like spouses that cannot live without each other ultimately. And so there is a bit of that kind of faithfulness. We just have to make it work. This is what has to be finally. And so God takes Israel back, second honeymoon, out in the wilderness. Hosea 11 is another family scenario where justice and mercy collide. this time with equally dramatic consequences. According to Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 and following, if you have a rebellious child who you have attempted to discipline, and you just cannot make this child live peacefully with you and your family, and this child insists on being incorrigible and rebellious, you are to take the child to the city gates, where the judges of the city sit, and you are to explain to the elders at the city gates all of your efforts by which you have tried to discipline this child, and you are to explain that you have failed, that you have done everything you could, and this child is still incorrigible. And if the elders at the city gates agree that you have done your best and the child remains incorrigible, together you and the rest of the villagers shall stone this child to death.
Good heavens.
And your eye shall have no pity. And thus you shall purge this evil from Israel. So, snotty, rebellious teenagers, death penalty. I don't know to the extent to which anything like this ever got practiced, but, you know, those of you who still have teenagers who never invoked this, I'm just kidding.
Divorce, no murder, yes.
Yeah. So that's what you do. You have a rebellious child. And I believe that Hosea 11, the first portion of it anyway, is written in the form of the speech that parents of a rebellious child make at the city gates when they have come to their wits' end and there is nothing left but to let the judge decide, shall we stone this child? When Israel was a child, I loved him, says the brokenhearted parent. And out of Egypt I called my son, but the more I called, the more they ran away from me and sacrificed to the Baals, offered incense to idols. I was the one who taught Ephraim to walk. Ephraim is an alternate name for the northern kingdom. One of Joseph's sons. I took them up in my arms. They didn't know that I was the one who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was like those who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and nursed them. This is just as much God the mother as God the father. Parents going together to the city gates. So they shall return to the land of Egypt, and Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The sword rages in their cities and consumes their oracle priests, devours because of their schemes. My people are bent on turning from me. To the Most High they call, but he does not raise them up at all. So the threat is against, this is a people, not a child, a single child. So I guess they gotta go back to Egypt. I guess they have to be destroyed because they simply do not wish to be in a relationship with me. So, destroy them. But then you get this, which is the equivalent of the suddenly shifting divorce proceeding. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How could I make you like Admah, treat you like Zeboim? And in case you don't remember where those are, those are the suburbs of Sodom and Gomorrah. that got annihilated when God did the Sodom and Gomorrah thing back in Genesis 18. My heart recoils within me. It's a very poignant piece of text that looks so bland in English. The word for recoil is precisely the word used in Genesis for what God did to Sodom and Gomorrah. The verb hafak, to utterly wipe out, to annihilate, to smite. At the very thought of doing the Sodom and Gomorrah thing on you guys, that's what happens to my heart. It's also the verb for what happened to the daughter of the daughter-in-law of Eli, when the ark got captured and the messenger came and said, the ark is captured and your sons are dead, and the pregnant wife of Phinehas went into labor, gave birth to a child named the glory's all gone. But she died in childbirth because her womb was smoked. Smitten. God's heart is ravaged like a womb of a mother dying in childbirth. My compassion grows warm and tender. There's a textual issue here. We don't know if the word for compassion is rechem or nicham. If it's rechem, it is God's womb flaming out. If it's nicham, the verb for repentance, it's that verb comes from an ancient root common to all those ancient languages that means to pant. To pant rhythmically. As one does in childbirth. So this is an utterly distraught mother whose whole self is destroyed at the very thought of losing the child. So I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, because I'm God, not a mortal. If I was immortal, I might go through with it. But I'm God, and so I won't. I am God, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. So the proceeding is stopped, and God simply says, so I won't throw the stone. I'll just sit with you. I'm with you. But here's the thing. Within a very few years, the stones did fly, and the Assyrians came, and everyone else said this was the punishment of God on this people for their unfaithfulness. But Hosea's oracle says it wasn't God who threw the stones. God said, no, I won't do it. Instead, I will sit here and hold this child. And so I picture this as God holding the child while the stones fly. Because they did fly. And did God give up the child? No. God could not give up that child. Would not. The faithfulness of Chesed says, I will sit and die with this child before I will give this child up. I mean, as a Christian, to me, I see theology of the cross here. And the question was not whether God was ever going to go down with the sinners, but when. And it happens more than once. The Christian story, you know, there are all kinds of stories of kindness and loving kindness. But the story line that I want to share with you that I think is a picture of Chesed that we are invited to follow is in Luke's Gospel. If you have a Bible, you might want to turn to Luke 23, verses 26 and following. This is in the Passion narrative of Luke's Gospel. At Luke 23, verses 26 and following, some things unique to Luke begin to happen that give us a picture, in my mind anyway, of the life of Chesed, as we might live it in Christ fashion. So as they led Jesus away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him, and laid the cross on him, and made him carry it behind Jesus. So in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Simon of Cyrene carries the cross for Jesus. In John's Gospel, Jesus carries it all by himself. Simon's out of a job. He's not even in the book. But in the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Simon of Cyrene carries the cross. But only in Luke do we get this extra little visual clue that he carries it behind Jesus. Jesus in front. Simon behind him, carrying the cross, following Jesus. It's a picture of taking up your cross and following Jesus. Or taking up the cross and following Jesus. There's another little place in Luke where Luke has added a word. In the call to cross-bearing that appears in all of the synoptic gospels, take up your cross and follow me. If you save your life, you lose it. If you lose your life for my sake, you save it, and so forth. In Luke, it says, take up your cross daily and follow me. Because Luke's audience wasn't exactly in the same sorts of dangers that at least Mark's audience was. At least in my and many other people's opinion, Mark was written for persecuted people. And if you take up your cross in Mark, in about 20 minutes you will be on it, and that will be that. But in Luke, it's a metaphor in every gospel. But in Luke, it's very definitely a metaphor of a life that is not probably going to find us literally nailed to crosses anytime soon. Luke's audience had some power and position so forth. But so daily, take up your cross and follow me. And so now in Luke 23, we're going to see Simon of Cyrene going to cross-bearing school and learning what a day of cross-bearing looks like. Jesus is on his way to die, and Simon is going to follow along and see how it works. So in Luke, and only in Luke, because Jesus is long since abandoned by everybody in Mark, but a great number of the people followed along, and among them were women who were beating their breasts and wailing for Jesus. But Jesus turned to them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children, for the days are coming when you're going to say, 'Blessed are the wombs that never bore. Blessed, you're lucky if you never had kids to go through the horrors that you're going to witness. You'll wish the mountains would fall on you and cover you up.'" So Jesus stops on his way to die to take up the concerns of other people. Listen, okay, people. I'm on my way to die, but you got real trouble. The whole place is going down, people. And what's in your future is unthinkable and unspeakable. Let's think about that. And what, for one thing, it's almost like Jesus says, "Well, if we're going to weep, let's not just weep for me. Let's weep for you and for all of us." His heart goes out to these people. He is with them in their plight, even though he's on his way to die, as are we all. Two others also were criminals led away to be put to death with him. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified Jesus with the criminals, one on the right, one on the left. And then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." There's a textual problem. That's not in some manuscripts, but it's generally by most thought to be part of Luke. Jesus stops to pray for the executioners, the very people killing him. Not necessarily the people who have brought things to this point, but the people charged with crucifying him. That's not just weird. There's a real concern here. Think about the lives of people compelled to spend their days killing people. It's hard enough to work in a slaughterhouse killing animals, but to have as your paid job killing human beings one after the other, think of how that dehumanizes you as well as the people that we're killing. Jesus is thinking about them, asking for their forgiveness. They cast lots to divide his clothing and the people who stood by watching. But the leaders scoffed at him, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself." The soldiers mocked him, coming up, offered him sour wine and said, "If you're the king, save yourself." There was an inscription over him, "The King of the Jews," which is, of course, a joke. Pilate put that there. "Here's what I think of you Jews. Here's your king. This is the King of the Jews." another joke there. It's our inside joke. Yes, this is the king that we follow. But one of the criminals who was hanged there kept deriding him, saying, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself. Hey, you with that king thing over your head. If you really are the Mashiach, do something about this." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Don't you fear God?" This doesn't happen in any other gospel, that a fellow condemned speaks to Jesus. "Don't you fear God, since you're under the same sentence? We've been condemned justly. We're getting what we deserve. This is justice. But this guy hadn't done anything." So he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Sort of like the people in jail with Joseph. You know, he's kind of going along with the joke. "Okay, so if you are the king, how about I get to be the baker? Can I be one of your guys? When you do take power, I'll be your lieutenant." And Jesus replied, "Truly, I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise," which is a Persian word that is used to translate in the Greek translations of the Hebrew Bible, the Garden of Eden. And the grammar, it's in Greek, so it looks like today you will be with me, but unless Jesus was up there speaking Greek on the cross, he was speaking his own language. And in that language, this would be a much more looser kind of way to refer to time. And Jesus is in effect saying, "Sure, buddy, you and me, today, you're with me. This is the Garden of Eden." That's another level of joke. Imagine the executioners going home after this one, telling their friends, "I don't know, you just never know what these crucified people are going to say. Today, these two guys were making plans." What are they going to do next after they're crucified? I think there's two things going on here, one of which is Jesus is telling this man, not totally unlike what happens in Hosea when God simply holds the dying child, dying with the child. Jesus says to the fellow condemned, "Sure enough, friend, it's you and me. But the fact that we're together, even here, makes this the Garden of Eden. This isn't only about some promised future beyond space and time. This is a picture of what it means to be with Christ, crucified with Christ, buried with him by baptism into his death. This is my favorite picture of the church. We are a bunch of crucified people saying, okay, now that we've been crucified, what's next? Believing that there is a next. And at the very least, what we do, like this man who's on his way to die and has only moments left, he is friend and companion, acting out chesed for the fellow condemned. At the very least, we can do that on our way to die. We can go together, so no one goes alone. Because we're all going, right? Nobody's getting out of this. So we die alone, so no one dies alone. Well, I must hasten because we've only got a couple minutes left. There's one more word from the cross in Luke's gospel, and it's a little different than Mark and Matthew, where Jesus dies crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's another psalm verse. It's Psalm 31, verse 5. Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. And when the centurion saw that, he declared him innocent. Not worried about the centurion this time, but that prayer from Psalm 31, verse 5. Which in the psalm verses, oh, into your hands I rest, I lay, I commit my spirit, O God, thou faithful God. It comes from a song that for many centuries, even before Jesus' time, was used as an evening song. And there is evidence from early Jewish sources that this verse, into your hands I commit my spirit, O God, thou faithful God, was taught by parents, by mothers, to their babies as a bedtime prayer. The way some of us learn, now I lay me down to sleep, I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. So Jesus dies in three of the four Gospels, praying, singing songs he learned as a kid. Only in Luke, it's a bedtime prayer, which is a way to conclude a day of cross-bearing. We're all on our way to die. And so we live on our way to die embodying chesed, showing mercy and kindness. Though we are on our way to die, to everyone along the path. And at the end of the day, we say our bedtime prayer. If we wake up, we do it again. If not, we're in the right hands. I think that's a picture of chesed. The kind of faithfulness, even unto death, that we show each other and that we show the world. Questions? Responses?
There's always an element of forgiveness in chesed, it seems like.
Yeah. Forgiveness is a big piece of chesed. Yeah. We've got to get past what could have divided us. A great deal of nevertheless.
You made some early allusions to Ruth, the book of Ruth. And I was wondering if you could understand Ruth as a picture of a chesed community.
Yeah, I think you could work that out. The name Ruth means friend or friendship. And the story of Ruth is, among other things, the story of a Gentile friend coming into the house of Israel. And this is a book that gets into the canon at a time when we're not too sure we want any Gentiles in. There were laws against Gentile spouses. The great divorce at the end of Ezra and Nehemiah, where all the foreign wives are chased out along with their children because we cannot afford to have foreign blood in the people. But Ruth is a Moabite. You know about the Moabites?
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing worse than a Moabite except maybe an Edomite. Ruth is a Moabite who marries into the family this man called Boaz, which is one half of the certificate that the building inspector puts on a building that is guaranteed to stand even if there's an earthquake. When the engineers check the buildings, they would put above a building they believed was strong enough. Yakin Boaz, built to stand, built in strength. Because Ruth is the word Hesed doesn't have a big part in the story, but Ruth is a friend who gets the faithfulness by her words to Naomi. She's a person who gets Hesed. We can have these people in our midst, yeah. We're out of time. Thank you very, very much.